Pick Podcast, Picks and Perspective with Chris Johnson.
Cool. Well, welcome, Josh. Thanks for being on Players Pick Podcast, man.
Yeah, cool, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, it's I've been actually having such a great day reviewing, going through all your stuff on YouTube, and I love you get some really good comments, some hilarious ones. Like, what was this one? I have to find this. It's just like about when you did the solo from Lingus. Somebody's like, oh, I'm pretty sure this guy is responsible for half the plays on the original tune. You know?
Yeah. No, there's some very funny ones, man. It's good.
Yeah, Snarky Puppy and Corey Henry. Amazing. Yeah,
the beasts. So good.
So how old are you now?
24.
Okay. So there's a high level of achievement here going on for 24 years old. When did you start playing?
Started when I was 7. And I got lessons from my dad initially. He taught me from that age. And I think I just came to him one day and asked him if I wanted to play, if I could play and get lessons from him. He was a professional double bass player and guitar player too. So music was always around. I remember he bought me my first guitar when I was 4, but I didn't really take to it as far as playing it properly. I would just strum and like jump around the house and make up random things and just hit all the strings, but that was it.
Sounds like a 4-year-old, honestly.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just, yeah. That's what I was doing at 4 and 5 years old. I didn't have a guitar, but I had a fishing pole, an old fishing pole that I acted like it was my air guitar.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd run around.
Awesome.
String it. You know, I think I had a headband or something that I would just go and, you know, try to act like a rock star, what I've seen on TV, you know?
Jimi Hendrix it up.
Exactly. So my dad was playing Jimi Hendrix and Black Sabbath and T-Rex. Yeah. That was all like back in the day.
Yeah.
So 7 years old, you actually kind of went to him and asked him to like give you lessons?
Yeah. From memory, man. I mean, I don't have much memory, but I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. My dad was starting to teach a couple of my friends. So I was like, oh, let me get on this as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If your friends are getting lessons from dad, you got to do it too.
You got to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Is your dad still gigging?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, here in Sydney, it's locked down again, unfortunately. So.
Oh, really?
There's nothing on. Yeah, for the past month and a half now. We've just gone straight back into a lockdown, so can't.
Even with all the vaccines being released, huh?
Yeah, I think it's pretty slow here because we were so lucky before. Like, we didn't have any cases, you know, since July last year. Basically, there was a couple sprinkled in, but. You know, hardly anything. And now it's bad. I mean, for Sydney, it's bad, which means like 150, I think, now a day, which, you know, compared to America or Europe isn't that bad, but for here in Australia, it's pretty bad. So.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm sorry to hear that. It seems inevitable that this thing might be around for longer than we would like.
Yeah, definitely. Unfortunately, so.
Are you, but you're able to... Do some, you're able to do, you did like a few gigs or something this last year though, didn't you? Or were those older videos with like the Philharmonic and?
Yeah, I was, thankfully. I got a fair few in with my band, just prepping for recording, you know, my album and trying out new songs, which was great to get in. So yeah, I'm pleased we got that. And hopefully in a month's time, we'll be back. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. And so you have a debut album that you're working on, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you have a timeline?
I was meant to record like right now, but because of the COVID thing, it's been pushed back. So I'll be recording end of September, hopefully. If COVID goes on, I'll be having to push it back later just because we can't rehearse or anything, try out new stuff. And then... You know, get it mixed and mastered, and I'll produce it a bit. So hopefully by the end of the year it'll be out. We'll see.
Mm.
That's my ideal timeline.
Cool. And you
Yeah.
kind of have a few different, at least from what I can tell, it seems like you have a few different modes. Like you have like
Yeah.
your cover mode, like where you're transcribing stuff and doing really cool intricate solos or horn solos or piano solos or something like that. And then you have like these beats that where you're doing kind of more hip hop electronic stuff. And then it's like more like maybe with the trio or with the band, it's more traditional-ish kind of fusion jazz. I don't, what would you say that the solo album's going to be? Is it going to be a like some sort of mix of those styles or? Oh, really?
Definitely. Yeah, I definitely want it to be quite a mix. I guess everything sounds, still the same, but it's definitely taking influences from I guess, yeah, jazz fusion, bit of metal and hip hop, I guess. Those four main. So I guess people like Tigran and Hamasyan, Animals as Leaders, Hiatus Coyote, that kind of vibe.
Mm.
All kind of jumbled together in like an instrumental sense.
Dude, I'm so
That's
hyped right
what I'm
now.
feeling.
You just said all the right words.
Man, yeah.
Wow.
That's three of my favorite bands probably at the moment.
Man,
So that's
yeah,
pretty wild.
well, and you play the Abbasi so well. I mean, you've given that some really
Thank
good
you.
love. I love seeing you. And have you acclimated? That's a seven string, right?
No, it feels fine now. Since I threw a little scratch plate on it as well, which I just needed for my right hand, for my pinky to rest closer to the strings. But since I threw that on, then it plays beautifully. I can, for me, it's just, yeah, it's
Yeah.
perfect. Yeah, it's perfect.
And have you found, I haven't noticed or not, but have you found much usage so far for the seventh string and the stuff that you're doing?
I especially like it for chordal playing. So just, having access to lower bass notes, which is cool. And with lead playing, it's definitely integrated where I don't really think about it anymore. But it allows me to stay in one position if I want to get nice and low. Finish a line, I don't have to stretch back and can hit that fourth down now, which is all fifth down, which makes things easier. For
Do you
sure.
have it still in a standard B or dropped?
Yeah, standard B, yeah. Yeah,
Okay.
I haven't dared drop it
All my
yet.
seven strings are dropped to A. It's
Oh,
AEA.
for real? Oh,
Yeah.
mad.
Just cause like I grew up. Well, as soon as I discovered drop D, I was like, okay, that's it. Drop D is super the coolest thing of all time. But then I found drop C and I was like, okay, I think drop C is like the best thing ever. But then you get a seven string, it's like, well, I could have a regular six string and then a drop A. Ah, it's kind
No, that's huge. I
of
should definitely try that.
Yeah. And it just
That
pulls
sounds
together
so
some of
handy.
those, some of those intervals come together and get funky in a cool way. I really enjoy
That'd be heaps heavy. That'd be sick. Go down to a low G as well.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, choices. Getting into eight string territory. Eight strings would be cool too, but a whole nother time of acclimating to it.
Hey, next, it's the next wave, right? Like, we'll just get finish this wave and you can put eight string in the next one and whatever. You never know. That Tosin Abasi, he's been a
Exactly.
real big influence on the world in that respect, you know.
Definitely.
I mean, I know Fredrik Thordendal obviously kind of broke that open in a lot of ways, but and before I feel like before Tosin, eight string was definitely still a novelty, like more way more of a novelty. And whereas now, in the last
Definitely.
10 years or whatever, we're definitely like it's legitimized instrument, right? And so many people are taking it on and taking the extended range that much more
100%.
seriously.
For sure. Especially because, him and Javier, they both play eight strings in a band and then don't have a bass player. It's pretty, it's sick. It's so cool. And
Right.
everyone seems to be wanting one now and using them. So, yeah, huge achievement for Tosin to get that going. Awesome.
Yeah. So I wonder about this when you first started playing with your dad and taking lessons, like what do you remember about the early times of like, did you start off using a guitar pick, or were you doing finger style in the very beginning? And
it was all picked straight away. I might post this photo soon, but there's just a picture of me sitting in the lounge room, actually probably within the first few months of playing, where I'm holding the pick really like basically the same way, but just a really janky version of it. So I did start with the pick straight away. I remember.
What kind of pick was it? Do you remember?
It was probably like one of those tortoise ones, like really thin. Not what I use now. I can't remember when I landed on the one I use now, but it might have been around 8 or 9. I think it was pretty quick. I remember my dad had this just little in Amsterdam, because that's where I grew up. They had these bikes called buckfietsers, and they're basically it's just means like box bike. So there's a box on the front where you could throw in, you know, anything you wanted. It was like having like a car with a big boot or something, but it was on a bike. So a bike with a big box in the front, you could still wheel it around. It had two wheels on the front. So me and my sister used to sit in there with my mates if my dad wanted to take us to the park or whatever. But he had like a little model version of that, which still does, like a red model version. And he just had a whole collection of random picks in there. So I think, you know, for the first few years, I just went to the little box bike thing and grabbed a pick out of that. And that was good.
That's cool. The box bike. I've seen those bikes before. I know exactly. I can see it in my head. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. No, they were great.
And so how you said you landed on the pick that you're playing now, like only a few years later. And so what is it that you're playing now?
Yeah, it's I'll show you. It's these like purple big stubbies.
Oh, you're a big stubby guy.
3 millimeter ones. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I love them.
Wow. Have you seen what Dunlop came out with recently? It's kind of like that. So they last year, actually, I'm sitting here holding one right now. It's the Flow Gloss, and it's this is the 3.0, and it's like it's indented just like the stubby, but it's a little bit wider from side to side here. Yeah, it's like the flow shape, but
cool.
And it's done with Ultex versus the purple ones are. I think they're a polycarbonate, so a little bit softer plastic. This is an Ultex.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'll have to give them a go because these wear out so quickly. I mean, I literally have 10 on my desk at a time because, you know, they just wear out, and then I have to change them up and find the one with the best point. But yeah, that'd be worth trying.
Yeah, that might be your jam. Flow Gloss. They got 2.0 and 3.0. So.
Yeah.
That's cool. Thanks, Big Stubby is legendary, man.
Yeah. Indeed, they sure are.
I know Tony McAlpine played the 3.0 for a long, long time, and Neely Brosh still plays the 2.0, actually. Even though I've tried to get her to try all kinds of their picks, and she's like, nope, she stays on the 2.0 stubby.
Right. Yeah, I guess when you find something that just clicks and you don't have to think about it anymore, then you just go with it. And I think that's what I found with the Big Stubby for sure. I do use, recently, since I went to NAMM beginning of 2020, these Gravity picks. I use these as well. Gravity 2.5 razors.
Oh, those look cool.
I've got three of them, and they're really awesome. And I find I use them more for the acoustic stuff. So for when I do the gypsy jazz or when I play nylon or whatever, I think these just have a bit better quality sound compared to the ginger. I mean, they're pretty expensive, so I would expect the sound quality that they produce probably to be a bit more, advanced compared to maybe the Big Stubby. But I just like the feeling of the Big Stubby, so I sacrifice that a little bit for that. But yeah, I'll switch between them. And I'll try it out every now and then and see if I can take to it. It's a little bit thinner and just it doesn't have that indent, which the Big Stubby has, which, I don't think I even use the indent. Like, my fingers wrap around the indent. I'm not even on the indent, except for my thumb. But it's like I've got two fingers either side of the indent there. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to show me how you hold the pick. I'm glad you're already doing it right there, because that's a kind of a unique way to hold it is the two pick. I mean, so many people are just the two fingers, you know.
Yeah.
And then, but you have like this kind of, and you kind of can turn back a little bit or in a little bit.
I guess so. I try and keep it pretty parallel to the strings with the pick, to be honest. I don't do much slant.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a weird grip, and I always, like, when I was a teenager, I was always in the back of my mind going, I should change to this, because, you know, I saw Sean Lane use it, Guthrie Gunn use it. I was like, that'd be probably better. But I felt like I was too far down the track of working on this technique to switch. So I was kind of like, let me just stick with it, because I know if I stick with something, it'll work out in the end. But yeah,
anyway. No, it's, I think it's cool when players end up making a unique style work like that, you know. For different things, not just guitar picks and guitars and stuff, but like, you know, like vocalists especially too, like when there's like, yeah, I don't know, like a guy like Dave Mustaine, right, like from Megadeth, yeah, like you put him up against any other actual regular metal singer and you're like, that guy doesn't have a voice, you know, especially if you hear him in the early days, you're like, what is this guy trying to pull, you know, but he's mad and that's cool, you know, so like, it kind of fits, exactly. but he over time like has crafted a thing and has created his own genre, his own style, and that is very recognizable. So it's kind of like you made the choice to stick with it, and now it's just a super successful thing that you've honed in on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think if you stick with most things long enough, you know, they will work out.
That's a good methodology. I like, you know, I remember Andy James, he used to get a bunch of like negative comments on the EMG TV videos back in the day. Right. He's like, oh, he doesn't use his pinky. and they're like, who is this guy? He's, you know, not using his pinky. Stupid. And then Andy comes on there and comments. He's like, hey man, there's no notes. There's no notes that I'm not playing that I want to play. So I'm playing every note that I want to play. What does it matter, you know, if the pinky's the one playing it or my ring finger? What does it matter?
Oh, absolutely stupid comments. can't tell Andy James what to do technique-wise.
No, monster. You sure can't. No, absolute monster. Monster. Yeah. 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 What a. Have you met him in person?
I haven't. No, I saw him play a little bit at NAMM, when, you know, same NAMM I went to 2020, but, you know, I didn't meet it. But I used to watch all those EMG videos and tried to pick as much technical tips that I could from him. Yeah.
That's cool.
He's a legend. He's awesome.
Yeah, he's such a great great chap in person too. Super funny and really. Real relaxed.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Great dude.
Hope to meet him for sure.
Yeah, well, hopefully if we ever have another, they say that we're having NAMM again next year. I don't know. Well,
I saw that on the website. Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. Like, so many things are like, yeah, cool, we're going to do that thing again. Oh, wait, maybe we're not going to do that thing again. Yeah, oh, yeah, we're going to do that thing. No, we're not going to do that thing.
Yeah, true.
so many ups and downs. And you keep saying, you're like, yeah, that NAMM 2020. And I'm like, it feels like 3 or 4 years ago to me.
I know. Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, for me as well. I'm like, oh, surely that was 2019 or 2018. But the beginning of 2020, then everything changed right after.
Yeah. So quick. Yeah, yeah. We've all been thrown for a big loop. I mean, do you have another job outside of doing music?
No, man, I can just do music, which I'm very thankful for. I just do a lot of teaching online, you know, through Instagram. People contact me, and that's been good. And working on a few. I do sell those tabs as well, which still tick over, and, you know, people are still interested in them, which is good. And I'm just working on a Patreon to launch that in like a week's time.
Great.
So working on vids for that and lessons, and actually trying to record myself do a lesson video rather than just, you know, playing videos, which is a whole new thing. So I'm gonna give that a go today. Actually, this is my first day trying it, so we'll see.
Oh wow, well, good luck on that, man. That's thanks, a cool man. Next step.
Yeah,
man, sure. I'm just so impressed with the way that you have seemed to, I don't know, I mean, like, do you feel like you had like a real knack for attention to detail at an early age? Was that something that kind of came to you?
I think so.
Okay.
I remember always being very particular about things that I was doing. I do a bit of art as well, and all art that I do is highly, I guess, very, very detailed stuff. Mm. Like, I don't like broad brush strokes or anything. It's real, real fine. Probably take way too long on things. But yeah, I think that's the same for guitar. And yeah, definitely. Always paying like really fine attention. I remember like whenever I practiced, I would make my laptop screen black so it was reflective, so I could see what my picking strokes would look like from that angle, so I could tell if my wrist was being activated or if I was using too much finger movement, or you know, if everything was looking right, because I didn't really have a teacher throughout high school, which is when I was doing most of my practice, so all I could go off was looking at people play and seeing how their wrist looked, and if mine was looking similar, I knew I was on the right track. If I was starting to develop habits that I saw people like Guthrie Govan and Sean Lane didn't really have, I guess those two of my favorite guitar technicians and guitar players in general. I would pay real close attention to their right hands in particular, because I think the right hand really drives everything. If the right hand's nicely dialed in and can do everything you want, then you know, left hand kind of follows in a way. So it's a lot of focus on my right hand. Keeps it detailed, I think.
It really shows, man. It really shows. There's a what I was gonna say is that there, it feels like it's like a supernatural like mastery of the instrument at what I still feel like is a young age for you. 24 is still a young age to be coming into to be transcribing a lot of these horn deals like Coltrane and different things. Yeah. Can you give some insight? Like, did you just like hear that music and then just get really like lost in it and then just couldn't not do it? Is that kind of the thing? Or
definitely. I think at a point I found myself more attracted to the sound and the playing style of saxophone players, way more than guitar players, for whatever reason, at maybe 15, 16. So yeah, at that point I just, the majority of stuff I've transcribed has been from saxophone players, especially tenor saxophone, so Coltrane, Michael Brecker, Chris Potter, just to name a few, definitely are my faves. I just tried to, I would approach it just like I would approach transcribing guitar, which up until that point I was just doing kind of guitar players, Borelli, Legrand, Sylvain, Luke. Every day I tried to learn like one or two or three licks, basically, by transcribing them. So I found that, you know, that was the only way I was actually going to improve the vocabulary on the instrument and learn new things to play, rather than just practicing technique, which, you know, is just going to give you the facility to be able to play the vocabulary you want to play. So I found transcription the only way I could really amass vocabulary nicely, and it was my favorite thing to kind of practice, figuring out stuff. Like, it's kind of solving puzzles when you like load in a 10-second file into, you know, I have a few slowdown apps. One's called Transcribe Plus, which is really useful. And then you just loop a little section, slow it down. I would slow it down for like 25%, and then just sit there figuring out the intervals nice and slowly, and then kind of solving the puzzle that is, especially with people like Coltrane, where some of the notes are pretty obscured, like that Percival solo is. There was a lot of passages in there that really I kind of had to, it was just trial and error for notes. I knew he started on this low note, finished on this high note, but what the hell is he doing in the middle? It's kind of trial and error, knowing like what intervals he probably, you know, would be playing if the chord was this, which notes, you know, are color notes that he might be playing, trying those first and then trying the other intervals and kind of solving a little puzzle every phrase or something.
And you were doing this basically on your own without a teacher's guidance. You're just hearing it and going back over and over by ear, trying to pick it out.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. For sure. And that Coltrane solo is the hardest one I've done to date, I reckon, just because it's so hard to hear what he was doing. in certain bits. I mean, it's really going wild. Huge intervallic leaps, which I didn't really even realize when just listening to them normally and then trying to figure it out. It's really weird phrases. I haven't heard or tried to work out anything like it since, which is pretty cool. I might go back and do another culture in one. Yeah. It was wild.
Man, I'm so impressed. It's like it's like what some people will go home and sit and do a puzzle with their family, you know, and put a puzzle together. It's like, yeah. Josh, you sit at home and like put a Coltrane solo together, you know.
Yeah.
And it's cool.
Thanks. Thank you.
It's like that's got to be like, you know, in a way that's got to be your teacher. That was probably your teacher through a lot of years, right? To do that. Do you have perfect pitch or a form of it?
No. I don't think so. No, definitely. No, if I practice a lot, I can sing an E, but that's about it. So it's just whether I'm super exposed to music or not. I can sometimes remember pitches, but no, I definitely don't have it.
Wow.
Relative pitch, I guess, would be there from just comparing intervals all the time, but I haven't done any formal practice on like interval. I did a little bit in university, actually. We did some. There was a class called ear training, which basically just went through a lot of intervals and picking out intervals and chords, identifying chord types, all that kind of stuff. So I did a bit of that there. But yeah.
So I imagine your ear to be well trained, but it's interesting to hear because some players at this level, right? Like that's like part of the magic is that I've got perfect pitch. And you're like, oh, well, okay, well that obviously is a big help, but you're telling me that I can tell that you obviously have a relative pitch, right? So you can hear something and kind of find the interval pretty quickly in relationship to what you're hearing. But it's not like a fundamental sound where you know where middle C is in your head all the time type of thing.
I see. Yeah, definitely not. I wish I had that. I mean, I think things would be a lot easier.
Well, I was talking to Ben Eunson, he has a perfect pitch, right?
Oh,
and
does so, he? Right.
Yeah, we had that conversation, and I was just like, I go, is it also kind of like a curse too? Do you have to like deal with like the fact that the world is super imperfect, you know? Yeah. Like, and you hear all these. He's like, I have had a season of like getting through. Like he said there was a season where he had overanalyzed sounds in his environment because he could hear the train whistle down the road was a particular, you know, dissonant key chord thing, you know, and it's just like, and he says, I've come to some sort of, peace with it at this point, you know, like and he finds beauty in the imperfections versus having to try to straighten everything out. So.
Yeah, that's cool. I'd be awesome to be able to just identify something just by hearing like an abstract sound, like a train whistle and going, oh, he's playing a D flat.
Yeah. I always thought it would be cool too, man. But I, you know, and I'm super on the other side of it. I mean, I actually, it's interesting though. The more I do find that the more I play, go figure, the more I play, the more I practice, the more I'm on my instrument, time on the job, that I'll turn a song on and just to jam like some random song. Sometimes I've never even heard it. I'm just like, oh, and all of a sudden my fingers just go right to like the key, and I'm like, okay, that's a win.
That's awesome.
But the opposite is also true sometimes too, like where I put stuff on, I'm like, where the hell is, how do I even find the key? And I'm scrambling around, don't understand it.
They're playing in a 13th key.
There's something else here. Or what I think oftentimes, usually it's something that's more difficult than my brain. I can't hear or don't know the chord changes well enough or anything to find a center. And I want to hang out and find a center when the center is always moving. Yes. So there's that too.
Yeah, for sure. No, yeah, I've definitely had that too. Gone to try and learn a transcription and thinking exactly where the note is and then playing it and it's nowhere near. And then it's just sort of, where the hell am I? There you go.
So you must read a bit then too, right?
My reading is pretty dreadful. I can read and I do know what the notes are, but I can't sight read like I would read a book. Like I can't read music.
Okay.
like words, but you know, I can figure it out pretty quick, especially if I hear it. But I generally, I think of every note as an interval when I read it. So even if, you know, I'll actually prefer if I have chords written right above, because then I can go, if it's A minor and that's C, D, I can easily just go flat 3-4, and I actually think of all the notes as numbers rather than kind of the note names, if I have like a reference of a chord over the top, which I think slows me down maybe a little bit, because I can't really turn that off. I always have to think of the interval related to a bass note. So if I'm learning, if I'm learning a tune or whatever, I'll kind of write out what the keys are of particular melody lines, so I can remember exactly what intervals I'm supposed to be playing and what the reference for myself is.
That's cool. You have your own system.
Yeah. But I think that it does slow me down. I'm learning all this. I've got a gig coming up. It's end of November now, but it's a quintet gig with a violinist, pianist, bass player, double bass player, and accordion player, and I'm on kind of nylon and jazz guitar a little bit, and it's just doing a lot of Piazzolla's repertoire and you know, kind of contemporaries in the sphere doing similar stuff, and I have to learn like 10 or 11 tunes, all super intense, that just require a lot of reading and a lot of figuring out stuff. So doing that at the moment, I got a bit more time now. Initially the gig was in August, but that's been moved back because of COVID, so November it is, and I'll have to go pretty slowly through all the charts, but that's been fun. It's definitely a new experience playing that music.
That sounds incredible. Cool
music. Yeah, incredible music to play.
Al Di Meola or John McLaughlin?
Oh shit, that's a good question. I don't know. I like them for different things, to be honest. I can't say.
When I hear McLaughlin, I think he's more alien, you know? I think he's more like other language. Al D's created his own universe and it's really cool.
Yeah.
But I personally get tired of Al quicker, whereas I feel like John has a little bit more of an expansive vocabulary. Maybe, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, no, I kind of see it the same way for sure. My intro to both of them was through watching clips of Barelli Legren, and there's a couple of clips of him playing with either of them. So that was my first intro into both of them.
Barelli's awesome.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites of all time. So yeah, there's a clip of him playing with Aldi doing a full gig, I'm pretty sure. I think there's another guitarist there as well. Might be a trio. And then there's a clip of him doing duo stuff with John McLaughlin, which is cool too. So but I definitely agree. I think, like, you know, Aldi has that ferocity and like they're picking everything, just huge intensity. But his language seems to be, you know, it's you can hear his style from a mile away, and you know, you really can recognize him from what he does. And then John McLaughlin seems to be doing a few, just trying other stuff. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to pinpoint if it's him that's doing it or he's trying new things all the time. Maybe that's what, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's he's awesome. Also quite, you know, recognizable too on most albums, but he can, it's like he can disappear into the music a little bit more. Right.
Yeah. True.
I mean, the other comparison was Holdsworth or Pat Metheny.
Yeah. You know?
Like,
sure.
Different. Holdsworth being the out of the tube, the guy that is more distinct and, you know, created his own world and everything. And Metheny being maybe having a wider vocabulary. Right.
Yeah. That one's a really hard one. I think those two are like neck and neck as far as most areas of music. That one's way harder to pick.
But see, I mean, I could also hear you or anybody else argue that Holdsworth has a greater or a wider vocabulary because of the outer reaches of which he's exploring.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, in a way, I think, they both have super distinct languages. I'm trying to think of like the different areas. I guess, you know, they both have their like outside methods. They both you know, it's very distinct when they both use them, and the inside stuff's very distinct as well. Yeah, I think, yeah, they both have incredible vocabularies. I think mm. they always come up with something new when they play. It's never the same.
That's true. And I'll say my buddy Joe, I mean, I've always kind of appreciated Holdsworth, but I never like really maybe gave him his complete due until I met my buddy Joe, and he was just like such a whole, he was like, no, listen to this. No, these licks, this is way bigger than all the other things. And I'm like, okay. And, and then he's, you know, he's made me practice some different lines that like, to get me out of my own box. Right. Yeah. And he's like, oh, find this language, find how do you play this type of thing? You know? And I'm like, okay, that's cool. Like when I try to just solely go into that world, and then I feel like I'm just lost and I just don't know. It's not my world. So I'm like, if I can if I can find a way out into it and get back, then I'm like, okay. Now it's usable. Yeah. Now it's part of my world, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's always, you always have to do when you transcribe things, is figure out your own beginning and own ending so you can actually incorporate it into your vocab. Because otherwise, it's out there and in a different universe and you don't know how to get between the two. I think Holdsworth, more so than Pat, maybe is like, there's still like a mystery about like how he was doing things, I think, which maybe with Pat isn't as recognizable from a technique point of view. Maybe from a harmony point of view, it's still like, what the hell was Pat thinking like when he was playing. Holdsworth, I have no idea. I tried transcribing that Protocosmos solo, and you know, I had to leave out a lot of notes that I couldn't even hear were there, but the rhythm would suggest that they were there. It was like he was hitting double notes all over the place without you even realizing. So he was extending, making the rhythm faster than it appeared to be, because I would play the same notes, but my rhythm was slower, meaning that he was hitting all of those notes twice in a way, by hitting those doubles, which is why he's probably stretching all the time, because he constantly is hitting double notes, you know, fretting the same note on different strings.
Okay, that kind of actually makes some sort of sense in my brain right now.
Yeah, I think that seems to be what's happening, because I would play the same notes as him back, slow and fast, but then when I was playing it fast with him, I could tell he was, for example, hitting 16th note phrases and I was hitting like eighth note triplets, so I was a little bit behind him as far as my rhythm, but I was still hitting the same notes, which meant he was probably throwing in a lot of double notes to make sure the rhythm was continuously kind of fast. I think that's what he was doing, but it was just too hard to figure out. Another one that was really tricky. And when you listen to me play, like certain passages, you can tell I'm a little bit slower than him, even though I'm hitting the same notes, but the speed isn't as fluid.
So you have a version of Protocosmos up?
Yeah. I transcribed one of his solos from the live clip. The first one that comes up on YouTube. That's my favorite solo, I reckon, of his on Protocosmos. Yeah, I'll send it to you after, man. It was at the beginning of the year. It was my first vid on the Abasi, actually, I
think. Oh, okay. I must have seen it then. I just, I'm blanking that that's what it was.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, man. Yeah, there's a backing track online for Protocosmos, and I don't ever try to play what he's playing, but I love trying to, like, make some sense over it, and it's insane.
Yeah, it's so good. So good. And I think... back to Pat, like, I remember seeing, you know, having the same feeling, like, how is he doing this stuff? I went to see a gig at the Opera House in 2014. It's probably still, like, one of the best gigs I've ever went to. It was a Pat Metheny band with Chris Potter was there as well. Antonio Sanchez playing drums. It's just, like, the whole lineup. He had a lot of his orchestral stuff there as well, so he was tapping in and making some loops using that. He was doing all the tracks off like the New Year album, I'm pretty sure it's called New Year. The Unity Band, that's what it was. It was like the Unity Band albums. doing all those songs, and like halfway through the gig, maybe it was in the second half, him and Pat just did like this 10-minute solo version of Cherokee, just blasting full. I think they're upwards of 300, just absolutely blasting for 10 minutes. It was insane, like how stamina was like that strong with improvising. They were weaving in and out of each other with lines. It was, yeah, one of the most unbelievable things I've heard. I think they have a version recorded from memory. Like, I was absolutely floored with that one.
So that sounds amazing. So,
yeah.
I'll have to look for that.
I've done a full gig. Yeah. I've done a full gig with that Picasso guitar he has. I think that's what he calls it. It's got like 50 strings on it, all like weaving around each other, all like tuned to different chords. Started the whole gig on that, like strumming away all these crazy patterns and stuff.
Wow.
It was awesome. Awesome.
If you find that, definitely send that to me. I would check that out.
Yeah, I will definitely. Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think they did Cherokee or All the Things You Are. It was one of those two. But unbelievable. Like, so good.
That's so cool. When you first started playing, do you remember what was your first song that you kind of transcribed or like you figured out by ear?
Yeah, well, my dad used to teach me everything then, so I don't think I worked. I might have worked a bit of like the Smoke on the Water solo out. That might have been my first like solo transcription of trying to figure out Smoke on the Water solo. But actual song, first song I learned was TNT, AC/DC.
Oh yeah,
definitely.
That makes sense.
Yeah. It was AC/DC and Deep Purple, and then Halem. I guess those were my three faves growing up. Black Sabbath as well.
Man, that version of Eruption you did is so spot on too. I love it. Thanks, I love that you did it on the Vi guitar too. It's like,
yeah.
I don't know. There's something cool about the whole vibe that you put together for that. It's really
Thank you, man.
Really, really well done, obviously. And,
yeah, I really tried to get every detail pretty close. It's pretty close. I was, there was a few things where I was like, that could have been closer to. I really wanted to make it like Eddie's, like a full-on, highly detailed version of what he was doing. And it was so tricky. Some of, especially his like rhythm, like some of his longer, fast lines, there's just such a weird little swing, which sounds awesome, but it's so hard to tap into. It's like he was swinging his head like for just a brief second, and then he would go out of it and just do his shred stuff. But he really had that quality to his playing. Maybe, just like this little lilt. There's one bit in the middle before the E major bit, the right before that whole section there is incredible. I just have the loop on that one section and try and copy exactly what the rhythm was and speed it up, try and get into that mindset. Super fun. I think I tried to get every whammy hit the same, but I think I hit four in the first bit rather than three, so that's another one I got wrong. But yeah, I tried to get it as close as possible. Really close.
Yeah, for the vast majority of us, I think it was like it felt spot on, you know.
Thank you.
And like it's cool that you to hear you breaking down, trying to figure out the swing, kind of superimposed swing sessions.
Yeah,
you know, in there, because there's obviously a feel change inside of it, and there's no metronome to sort it out with. So. It really is an overall, like you have to like study it hard to pull that off with the similar feel.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah. I really tried to get that down. It's so cool. I don't know what he was thinking when he did that bit, but it sounds so awesome when it comes through. And there's more. The just like drop into silence as well. I love that too. Before the that bit. That's so cool as well. It's like a masterful performance. I don't think anyone's gonna come close to that. It's so amazing.
Yeah, agreed. It's like not only was it masterful, but it was at the time that it came out, there just was nothing that could come close, or could even, you couldn't compare it to anything. There's nothing to, and then so, and here we are in 2021, still talking about it.
Yeah, man. You know? We will be for many hundreds of years. I'm sure.
If we last that long, I would imagine so.
My dad tells me all the time, like, you know, when he was, I think he said when he was, I want to say, between 12 or 16, I can't exactly remember, it came out, and he said it just sent, like, the guitar world into a frenzy, like, everybody was trying to learn it, and, you know, there would be rumors about, like, some guy down the road who had figured it out, so you go around his place to try and learn it, and, like, all that, so everybody was trying to figure out how he was doing it, and, yeah, my dad used to play it, like, at gigs he would do. Before one of their songs, he had like a rock band. I think he was in it when he was 15, 16 or something. He would tour around Sydney, and he said he used to play it.
Wow,
yeah, which is cool.
That's really cool. Man, you're lucky that you got a dad to go and ask for lessons from, and just be like, matched up, right? Because you can imagine all the kids out there that either don't want to play and don't get that, or don't want to play but have a dad or a parent, you know, that's like, come on, kid, I want you to play. I got you a guitar, and the kids are like, nah, I want to bake cakes, you know, I want to do something else. Yeah. I want to be a lawyer, a doctor.
So true. And I mean, not that not just that I could, you know, go to for lessons, but that he would get up every morning with me and, you know, teach me new things before school, like for an hour.
So wow.
Lesson every day before school for an hour. And then after school, he'd maybe teach me a song, or we'd write a song together or something. Me and my sister and my dad and a couple of my friends had like this little band. And we'd each have like little stage names. It was pretty cute. And then we'd do gigs around Amsterdam.
Yes. What was your stage name?
Mine was Jojo Lightning, which is pretty badass.
Jojo Lightning. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Lightning. And so my first YouTube channel was called that. I think it's still out there. I don't even know what the password is or anything, but there's some old clips on that.
That's cool.
And I think we were called like Jojo Lightning and the Rock Kids. That's the name.
Hell yeah. That's tough. That's tough. For how old were you when you were playing?
Like 9 or 10. Probably started it when I was 8. Yeah, earliest photo might be when I'm 8.
That's awesome. That makes me happy.
My sister was 4, and she was tiny. She had to stand on a box to get up to the mic stand. There's a lot of cute photos.
That is super cute. And your dad played with both of you?
Yeah, he would play either like rhythm guitar or. Yeah, no, he would play rhythm guitar. So I'd play the lead stuff. One of my best mates would play bass. Another mate played piano sometimes. Sister would sing. There wouldn't be a drummer usually. We couldn't find any like good drummers at that age. Maybe it's such a like responsibility to keep time. It's sometimes hard to find kids who can handle that. So I think my dad even used to use like tracks or. You know, we play with a track or like a drum machine or something just to make it fill out the sound and stuff.
Sure. Man, that is I love hearing that. That's like, and the fact that you just had a natural inclination towards playing. I love hearing a story and hearing about people, because when we're young, we're so pure. In our pursuits, right? Like we're so like, we just see something, we're like, I don't know, I don't have any analytical reason why I want to do it. I just know that that's my thing and I'm going for it, right? And that makes me happy. That makes me really happy.
Yeah, that's so cool.
That's awesome. I'm curious, what do you, like what concerns you most about our modern age?
Oh, that's a good question, man. Don't usually ponder those kinds of thoughts. That's a tricky one. I guess you know, it might be something to do with like social media and being addicted to it or something.
Do you feel like you're addicted to it?
Not really, but I'm trying to dial that back. You know, sometimes you can end up on it and just lose, you know, a certain amount of time, which you're not even consciously aware of. Like it sucks you in so much. So yeah, maybe it's that, like, you know, from my own personal experience, I know that it can be such an easy trap to fall into. And also, you know, the whole thing of maybe like, you know, posting stuff and like your real life is completely different to your social media life and everything, and that whole aspect to it as well. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I can...
no, that's probably not a big one, but like a social, I guess.
You're cutting out a little bit there.
Sorry, man, that's probably has changed everything, but oh, sorry, man.
It's okay.
Just yeah, probably a social issue would be social media. I don't know. What would you say to that, man? What would your...
Well, I mean, it's difficult. It's a really wide question, right? It's why I ask sometimes to see what might be at the forefront of your mind when it comes up, right? And for me, you know, social media is in the middle of the primary problems, I think, so to speak. I mean, it's both a facilitator and a catalyst for a certain amount of connection and a certain amount of potential change in the world, which is, on one hand, I'm still like thankful for it. I'm thankful that, look, we get to beam our conversation through space and then rebroadcast this for people to pick apart and enjoy later, right? But and there's all these different ways in which the internet and social media are helping, but because the predominant narrative is controlled by people with money and the people that own most of the platforms and stuff like that, that poses a really difficult situation for us to actually find the truth about what's going on in our world, right? Because
100%, yeah, 100%.
All this money is over here says, oh no, that's not happening. Yeah. It's happening like this, or it's not happening at all. And and then a certain amount of people just buy in because they read about it, or they even just saw the line, and they didn't actually even. I mean, we mostly ingest, you know, these kind of sensational, headlines, so to speak, more than we do the actuality. Details. Yeah. The details, right? So, and it's so, and it, and now we're in a, it feels to me, I think that the statement that comes to me is that that kind of classic thing that you hear every once in a while, where like the greatest trick the devil ever played was convincing you that he didn't exist. And I say that in reference to kind of like this kind of big money billionaire like mogul status, where you have all the media owned by a couple of people, and you have there's a conglomerates around you know, our healthcare and pharmaceuticals and all this stuff, so that if they can convince you that, oh no, we're just doing our best over here, that's no big deal, we're just, oh, you know, oh, whoops, well, we're not smart enough to like actually have a plan to like be devious, no, don't, you know, the government included. And so there's a part of me that feels like they play that card really, really well. And
that's
they
true,
have the money to pay people off to kind of reinforce the thing. And then I'm like, and so because of that, there's this, what it feels like a massive gaslighting, you know, like, oh, what you're feeling and seeing with your own eyes and with your body, that's not happening. This is what's happening. And so, and it creates splits in our psyche, right? So if I constantly tell you, Josh, you know, what you're seeing isn't real, then after a while, there's a thing that, there's a psychosis that can happen, or a break that can happen.
Well, yeah, it's probably why we're, you know, it feels like we're just at each other's, you know, throats more than ever, as far as, you know, sides and, you know, the world, because the social media has complete control over that narrative in a way, unless you know, and also the thing of as soon as you click on one or two sides or one or two opinions, it'll just throw that opinion at you nonstop, and you don't really can't really get the other side in a way sometimes. And the, you know, there's the whole censorship thing with it too, which seems a bit wild. And but yeah, I'm, it's just one side that's kind of, you know, that that money and the social media platforms, they're in control of all of those narratives now. They have complete control in a way, because that's, you know, if there was probably a tally of what people use the most on their phone, it'd be social media by such a long shot.
Big wide margin. Yes.
Yeah, massive wide margin. So
especially for this, which is interesting because it's for artists and creators, it's like it's a lifeline in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Right?
It's incredible. Yeah, it's incredible. Are you kidding? Yeah.
So I mean, like, I'm just even thinking about right now, thinking about your situation. Yeah. You haven't released a debut album.
Nothing. Yeah. Yeah. Nothing would be possible with.
But you have an audience waiting for it right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. In previous years, it's like you would have had to tour the world to have amassed the type of email list you have now, multiple times over. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
But and instead, I've
just been sitting in my bedroom, you know, turning on a camera. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's ridiculous that it's, you know, that powerful. So, you know, I think ultimately it is good, but it's just going to be a careful one to watch, I think, which I'm sure people are doing too, but yeah.
It'll be interesting to see.
Such a big change.
Yeah, it has been such a big change. And I think that it will be interesting to see if and when we can get a more neutral platform that gets adopted.
Yeah.
Right? That will be interesting. I don't know if it'll happen.
It's hard to imagine that it would happen, but because the platforms now are so powerful, I think, you know, anything that pops up that's new, it's like these big platforms just will buy it. They'll offer just, you know, and massive. I think that's what most of them do already, right? Something else pops up, they're able to just, you know, buy it and then incorporate it into their thing, and then it slowly disappears. And
yeah, that's true. That's or just add that feature. They'll copycat the feature, yeah, and then now it's available. You don't need to leave Facebook. We have stories now too. You don't leave there because we can make it like TikTok too. You know, it's that vibe. Interesting. And you know, the blessing and the curse scenario, I guess.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, were you raised with any type of religious belief or anything like that?
No, not at all. To be honest, man. Nothing really. I think, you know, maybe, you know, the furthest would be like reading the stories, but more so as myths rather than anything. That was it.
Is there any philosophy that you've come across or developed on your own that you kind of, is there any principles that you live by that you would kind of say that help guide the way you live or make decisions?
Yeah, good question, man. I think nothing in writing, but yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, I guess I'd probably adopt everything. You know, I guess, you know, Christian values probably. I think we're fairly, family is fairly rooted in that still, even if we don't, you know, talk about any of it or you know,
sure,
actually identify with it. I know, I guess, you know, main one is probably like treat or say things to others that, you know, don't say things to others that you wouldn't want them to say to you, or don't have that double standard or something or anything like that when it comes to relationships or maybe that one.
A bit of a golden rule type of thing. Do unto others as you would have done to you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That one, I think probably.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good way to live, man. I mean, because there is a contrary concept around that. Like, you know, some people say, "Oh, you should, you know, do it. If I do unto you as I'd have done unto me," that doesn't necessarily, you know, the way
it could be bad.
It might not be work because that's the way I want it, right? Doesn't mean that's the way you want it. So you have to get to know someone. Technically, like they say, the platinum rule I think that's the golden rule, is do unto others as you would have done unto you. But the platinum rule, if I may be getting this wrong, but is that you would do unto others as they would have done unto them, right? So to find out, to be in relationship with them long enough, on some level, to get them know them well enough, and then go, I know how to give you a gift. I know how to talk to you now, because I hear what your concerns are, right? Implementing a kind of an assertive or even aggressive way of going, well, it's no big deal. I wouldn't care about that. And meanwhile, you care about that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. Yeah. That I've fallen into that before. But yeah. So platinum rule. What about yourself, man? Do you have any that come to mind?
Yeah. I mean, I was raised Christian, and I still marvel at that whole thing. My mom is still very much a believer, and my sister feels connected to it. And I do, because I was raised in it. My grandmother was very, very interested in it and took me to church a lot. And I have felt things there. I haven't been able to completely discount it, even though I'm super appalled at all the things that have been done in the name of Christianity, right? So,
of course,
there's that. In my adult life, it's been more, I've done a lot more studying with Eastern religion, Buddhism, and Zen, and a lot of that. And then I ended up becoming a yoga teacher. And so now that, just, there's a lot of yogic philosophy, which comes from India and through the years that kind of trickled into Tibet and China and into, you know, Japanese Zen. And I kind of love all of those threads. I love reading about it, and I love the kind of open source philosophical ways of looking at things. I don't necessarily have a hard and fast way of living, but yeah, some of the Christian values are of great importance. I think, you know, they're kind of basic stuff that makes sense. The overall dogmatic quality and specifics in Christianity kind of turn me off at times, but I'm more of a universalist. Also, ultimately, I'm like, oh, there's truth over there. Oh, there's truth there. That's cool. So, you know, that's cool, because Islam has a really beautiful truth about it too. You know, oh, that's cool. Jainism and all these different kind of outlooks. And I kind of consider myself a little bit of a, you know, I don't want to say like I'm, it's kind of, I just, I'm a bit of a connoisseur around it. I just like hearing how people get through their day if there's something that ties it in for them, because to some people it's really important. But like talking to you and hearing how kind of neutral you are a little bit, I'm like, oh, well, maybe it's just really this, like music is more of your religion or more of your language that you
always,
right? You know, like you're just
cued
into that instead.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. If there's one thing I think about more than anything else, it's 100% music. So yeah. For sure, and I'd say very similar. You know, there's truth everywhere, and it's cool, you know, to pick what works for you, and you know, thinking about and accessing different things that people have thought a lot about, and you know, obviously work for a lot of people. You know, there's always going to be value there for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool.
They say that that music is actually kind of one of the higher forms of a spiritual kind of experience in a way, because especially instrumental music, it's invisible, you know, and we feel it. We feel it in all these different levels in our soul and in our physical self and psyche. And so in some ways, in some of the kind of esoteric philosophies, they kind of hold it in this super high place, and that musicians in old days would be held as high as like a medicine man or whatnot, because they'd be kind of like transcribing energies and messages from the gods or from the ethers, you know? Do you kind of feel like, do you feel that you, that you're writing when you write, or do you feel like, where do you, where do the ideas come from when you create?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess the same with improvisation, right? Like where are these things coming from when you play and improvise? And I think it's I think for both cases, like composition and music and improvisation, it's probably, you know, it's certainly just a sprinkle of kind of everything going on. It's certainly that, it's certainly things that come out of nowhere, but it's come out of your subconscious, I guess that would be the best way to explain it, because it's probably not nowhere. It's things you've thought about in your subconscious without realizing it, and then it's coming forward at a given time. That's how I think most music works. It's, or you know, most skills in general, I think it's you practice to load your subconscious with information that can come out without thinking about it. So if you think about your technique, everyone's technique, if you're at a certain level, is subconscious. It's not like you think about the feeling of playing, it just kind of happens. Same with improvisation, like it'll just happen if you've practiced vocabulary a lot, or if you've practiced a few patterns heaps. If they're uploaded and like they've been downloaded into your subconscious, then consciously you can think about other things when you play or other things when you write, and maybe that's the more analytical side of, you know, is this working? But your fingers are just going, they should just be kind of going, or you know, your, I guess your fingers are, should be informed by your oral, you know, what you're thinking in your mind that wants to come out, and then your fingers obey to that. But I guess, yeah, that's mostly subconscious, I think. But, you know, maybe for some people, it definitely gets a lot deeper. You know, when you see someone like Keith Jarrett play, it's hard to, you know, not believe that he's completely entered this spiritual trance, and whatever's coming out is, he's a full-on just, what would you call it, like a beacon for, you know, messages way beyond what we can understand when he plays. That's certainly the feeling that comes out.
Do you ever get any of those type of feelings when you're,
I think really like when everything's going right and you're playing music live, it kind of, I feel like it has to happen when you're actually performing for people. And that's when I've had a couple of experiences where, you know, you just completely lose all thought for a few minutes, and everything that comes out, you have no idea what's really going on. You're full on just passenger to the moment. And I guess a lot of improvisers talk about that state. I think Stan Getz had a term for it, which I can't remember now, but he certainly talks about it. And, you know, all musicians are just trying to relive that moment every time they play, because it's almost like my dad would tell me, like, it would be like a, you know, there's nothing better than hitting like the tube of a wave when you surf or something. So every time you surf, you're trying to hit that point. And, you know, most of the time it doesn't happen if the waves aren't right or whatever. But when it does happen, you just don't want it to end. But yeah, I guess it's the same thing with improvisation, I reckon. And, you know, I can count a few times that's happened where everything is just, you know, it really has to be, everything is right. Like you get on well with the band, so you're not thinking about that. That can be taken off. You're not worried about your sound, like you can hear yourself, but it's exactly what you dreamed of your sound being, so that can be ticked off your thought. Then you can, you know, you don't have to worry about technique because you've worked hard on that for however many years and everything's flowing, so you don't have to think about that anymore. So it's just like getting rid of all these thoughts that would be cluttering your brain when you play, and just letting it all kind of go. You don't have to think about the chord charts because you've played over these tunes a million times, so you can recite the chords frontwards and backwards and know exactly what they're meant to sound like. All those thoughts are away, and then just whatever happens. So yeah, you know, to prepare yourself for that moment as much as you can, I think it's important in getting there. But yeah, that's how I kind of feel
about it. Have you had that experience where you kind of wake up and you're like, because traditionally I think it's, most people will call it the flow state, is kind of what we're talking about, this flow state, right?
It's true.
It's kind of like life in the gap between between thoughts, between you're not analyzing yourself, you're not observing yourself in any third person way of any kind, and you're somehow free from, you're energized by, but free from the analyzation of the crowd. Like you don't feel like, you know, held back by it. And but what I'm asking is, have you entered into that state and then started to like cognitively realize that you were in the state and then took yourself right out of it?
That's definitely happened. Yeah, for sure. Usually, it'll be just something small will happen, you know, and then suddenly, like, obviously, all those thoughts would rush back. And then your mind's cluttered again when you play. But yeah, that's definitely happened. I'll just hit something when I'm playing and not intend to, and then, you know, straight away you're snapped out of it. Or yeah, it's usually something you do, or like the way you hit a note to feel right or something. Like playing such a feeling based thing that if something's not feeling right, it just throws you off completely. And I've had that before as well. And maybe, you know, in a way, interesting stuff can come from that as well, where you're purely just thinking of one thing. Like I used to play a lot busking wise with my dad before COVID ended, and you know, we'd do about like 5-6 hours every day, Saturday and Sunday, of just playing standards together, duo. My dad would just play chords for me all day, accompany me, and you know, kind of be, it'd be lessons in a sense as well, because he'd be in tune with, you know, I'd be doing my thing, he'd be in tune with, you know, what the audience are thinking. You know, he'd tell me like if I'm just trying too much stuff and the audience is, you know, they're walking away, it's, there's no point in us being there. You know, what I'm doing is just too wild and crazy. So, you know, it could reel me in. But, you know, on some days, the way I was holding a pick might be like a millimeter different from what I'm used to. And for some reason, I can't get back to the feeling that I had the day before of how my pick felt. And that'll throw my day completely out the window, and I won't be able to play and I can't concentrate. And I'll just be thinking about this small feeling. It's usually in between my fingers. I'll get a weird sensation if I'm not quite right with holding the pick, and I'll get like just a feeling like in between my fingers, the way my fingers are like connected. That'll just throw my entire day out. Doesn't happen as much anymore. It was probably when I was younger trying to figure out my technique, but every once in a while I'll pick up the guitar and play and it just doesn't feel right. And you know, I know it's not going to probably be a good day playing from that point on.
So do you just put the guitar down if it's a practice session and just kind of like give it some space?
Yeah, I might do that and go into some other stuff. Like actually, you know, I might do a bit of writing or editing of vids or something, and then come back to it and see how it feels. Or I'll just push through. I find actually the one thing that gets me out of it, so I'll generally try and do this actually, is transcribe. So just learn something new. If things aren't feeling right, like it probably means my hands are just, you know, really want something new to play. So that's what I'll do. I'll just open a random song, find a lick that I like, learn that, and straight away, like everything will just line up again.
Shifting gears then helps.
Yeah, that's how I deal with it.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I find like learning something new will push my technique further than, you know, my overall playing, but especially technique further than anything else does, any other exercise or anything. I think learning something new pushes you the most, I think.
I reckon. Yeah, it's cool. Man, that's so cool to listen to a bit about your process around, because we're also kind of talking about getting unstuck a little bit, right? So when you kind of find yourself in a place where you're not feeling in coherence with your instrument, to be able to snap out of it some way. And that's, so like for me, I play with a few different styles of music. I do some hip hop stuff and I do the guitar stuff. And so I'm oftentimes I'll run into a brick wall with one of them and I'm like, oh man, I can't even make any headway. And so if I, but I don't want to stop making music or, you know, working on stuff. So I'll just shift and go, oh, well, or sometimes it's a different song, you know, like, oh, this song, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not figuring out the thing that I want to figure out for this right yet. And rather than push it too hard or try to keep beating myself up around it, try to shift the gears and just, or, you know, in a worst case scenario, go for a walk with the dog or, you know, go for a bike ride or something.
Just do something completely different. Yeah, man. Yeah, totally get you. Yeah. Sure.
Well, I'm curious about what, like, as far as a couple questions here, and you can answer them however you like, but one is, when you're in this process of putting together an album, do you listen to much other music at all? Or are you one that tries to stay away from, like, you know, listening to other stuff while you're writing? And, and what have you been listening to, in the last, year or so that you might want to share with us? Is there a player or two out there that, that maybe not be super apparent that you're super in love with and maybe the rest of us should check out?
Yeah, good questions, man. I'd say, yeah, I definitely listen to music for sure, man, all the time. And I actually have like a Spotify playlist of just inspiration, like sounds and things that, you know, I'll listen to a song and maybe it's the way they play the intro or something that, you know, something I like and I know I can take the blueprint from and use for my own thing, I'll just throw it in this little folder of songs I like. So, I mean, there's a lot of, a fair few things in there now, but it's the main artist. Yeah, Tigran Namasen for sure. He's one of my favorites in that form of jazz, which, you know, is you know, not like the more traditional where it's head solo, head out type kind of vibe of how to, you know, play standards or jazz. Yeah, it's more like through composed stuff, like the solos are really part of the composition. There's a different maybe solo form for every soloist. There's, you know, different parts, different interludes, a lot of different melodic sections, and that kind of sound I really dig. And I guess Animals as Leaders come into that as well. Similar. I really see them very similar. Mm-hmm. As far as the compositions, I like Polyphia as well. That's sick. Especially just how strong the melodic content is, and how they can really flesh out a melodic idea. And they're awesome. Kurt Rosenwinkel is definitely, and Pat Metheny, I guess those are my two favorite kind of modern jazz guitarists. So definitely inspired by him as well. Hiatus Coyote, like I said, just, you know, that awesome new kind of hip hop style thing that they kind of do mixed in with. I know a lot of jazz stuff too. It's hard to explain. I guess all these artists, they're really hard to put in one category, which is kind of what I like about them. Hard to like place a stylistic name on them in a way.
True.
Which, man, I like.
Hiatus Coyote is, such a breath of fresh air, this kind of like progressive neo soul jazz neo soul thing that like breaks like a bunch of, I don't want to say breaks rules necessarily, I mean, because obviously there's not a whole lot of rules like in music to begin with, there's just like things that are more common than others, but I'm impressed, and she's such a wonderful vocalist. Nay is
so good. Yeah,
it's just yummy. I remember when I first heard her, I was like, oh, because for a long time, like, I felt like nobody really had the vibe that Erykah Badu had, like nobody, like everybody, like she just, like Erykah's a good example of somebody that was obviously inspired by like Chaka Khan and you know, singers in the 70s and stuff, but she had her own thing when she came out. She had her own kind of nasally, like melodic, kind of, she had a swag about her that just like nobody else quite had, and you just like, it'd be weird if you did try to get at her thing, but then there's like two main singers for me that popped up. There's probably a third one, but like that kind of took a little something from Erykah Badu, and I think that Nay is one of them, but and you know, it's just there in a like a, you can hear it in a bit of an influence, but she's got so much of her own thing now that it I don't even hear that part anymore. But yeah. Also Little Dragon. I don't know if you're familiar with Little Dragon.
No, I'm not actually. I'll check that out.
More pop based, but okay. But yeah. has a little bit of the unique vocal quality that Erykah Badu kind of used. And so I don't know, just associating and hearing some of that influence in the Hiatus Kaiyote stuff really made me go, oh man, you know. And then to have the band be progressive and funky and
so good. Yeah. Oh. So awesome. Yeah. The band's amazing. Well, every single one of them. Yeah. Awesome.
You see Bender, the bass player, he put out a hip hop album last year. Did you see that?
Oh, did he? No, I haven't seen that. Check that out.
I forget what the name of it is. It's something that, like, he's like a 40-year-old white guy, like doing a rap album. Like he, is it? Right. Bender. I don't know. I'm not sure. Is it artist? I have to look it up, but he's definitely on his Instagram. But he had some really good tracks on there, and you might enjoy it because it was kind of,
check that out. Is he just making the beats and everything, or is he rapping as well?
He's rapping. He's making the whole. I think he did the whole thing, and he's got quite a few pretty clever songs. And I'm kind of like, part of me is a little bit mad about it. I'm like, oh fuck, it's, well, how do you get to be so talented, dude? That you're just gonna, I don't even, maybe it was a lot of work to put this hip hop album together, but you know, some people, you look at them, you're like, okay, I was already enamored by your main thing. And then like you have this side project that's, you know, it's not like it doesn't sound like a modern professional rapper, but it's quality. It's good. And he's got good, like funny rhymes. And I'm impressed. Super impressed. So
I'll definitely have to check that out.
Can't wait till they come back through on tour. I want to see them live again, big time.
Yeah, big time. And I've seen them a couple of times playing now here in Australia, three times maybe.
Hmm.
Or maybe it was, maybe twice, and then one Nay doing a solo thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which was sick as well.
Yeah. Last time Nay did her solo thing in LA, Tosin and I went to go see her together. And sat there and just like, we're so impressed with the whole thing, man. She's
with the
anyway,
the
we Jackson, can blow
the white Jackson.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I keep wanting to make her. I want to make her a Kiesel, because her.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that'd be badass.
I was kind of thinking actually, and this is kind of weird to do it to say this out loud here, but like, because Kiesel makes the upside down offset V. I was gonna make her an exact opposite, so I do a reverse headstock with an upside down V, offset V, and like do it black with like, kind of like a reverse negative a little bit, you know.
That would be so cool.
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, black with white. But does it have pinstripes on it?
It's got kind of got the Randy Rhoads type pinstriping on it.
Yeah.
I don't know if we do that or not, but I'll have to. I could do something that kind of made it close.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah, something similar. But yeah, I talked to her management a lot, and she chats with me on Instagram every once in a while. So, because I wanted to make her guitar. I actually want her on this podcast because she doesn't really use guitar picks, but like she's mostly with her hand, right? Every once in a while she'll use a pick. But when we hung out and talked a little bit in San Francisco, or it was actually maybe Oakland, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years ago when I was with Dunlop, and I had put some pedals on her pedal board, and she was all excited about it. And I was like, okay. So when we're talking, and I was like, hey, so what do you use for, you don't use guitar picks? And she's like, no, actually, you know, she's like, the thing that goes around your bread, you know, when you pull the little thing off of the bread.
For real? So yeah.
She's like, that's what I used as a guitar pick for a long time when I first started. I was like, oh man. I want to make her. I want to make her like a regular guitar pick with a picture of that bread tie thing on it.
Yes.
There's even actually.
Where is she?
Yeah. Right. But hey, man. You know, like just like if it works, you know, like whatever. my friend Moon Zappa, she, when she first tried to play guitar, she used an almond. She was like, oh, it's the right shape, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah, that'd be wild using an almond. I guess it's got the point. It's got a good point on it. Yeah.
I mean, it's probably not the best guitar pick, but when you're starting out, man, like, it's just like the most rudimentary things, right? Like, to make a big deal, and you're just like, oh, I'm gonna approximate the thing that I've been seeing people do. Kudos to anybody that starts anything and powers through being not great at it for a while, you know?
Yeah,
because
of course.
Oh my gosh, I mean, how long do we spend, how many hours does it take, you know? It's different for everybody, but you know,
yeah,
it can take a long time.
Yeah, 100%. And what else did you ask about the influences, man? Those are the main people I'm listening to at the moment. I guess, yeah, anyone unique,
any players, especially that maybe they're local to you that the world might not know that much about, would be really cool too.
A keyboard player from New York, I'm sure plenty of people have heard of it, but James Francis, he plays with Chris Potter. That's when I first heard him, but he's just released a solo album, which is awesome. So yeah, he's someone, been checking out a bit of like Ludwig Göransson as well, the film composer, I guess, composer for a lot of scores, film and TV series scores. He recently did Tenet, but he did like a couple of the Star Wars things. He's on the most shows, like he makes the themes for everything now these days. He's probably the most in the band guy, I'd say, for film and TV series scores. So he's great. I've been watching a couple of his vids, some cool compositional processes, and
cool. I'll have to check him out. I don't know anything about him.
I like just trying a lot of different things and seeing what happens. I get inspired by let me get his name. He does like all these awesome breakdowns of like Meshuggah, Tigran, Animals as Leaders, I'm pretty sure, tunes, where he breaks down the rhythm of rhythms and everything. He's a drummer himself, and he's played a bit with Tigran, I think. Let me get his name. But he's all the videos he makes are incredible, man. You should watch it. They're super inspiring. And he breaks them down so well. His name's Yogev Gabay, if I'm pronouncing that right. Cool. Yeah, everybody check him out if you want it. You know, if you just the way he explains the Meshuggah songs, like it just makes so much sense how he does it, and really get a strong understanding of how they're coming up with all of their rhythmic processes and the rhythmic forms they're using and how things are overlapping, and super interesting stuff, how and what kind of sound it makes, and how what they use for different sections, and you know, he'll figure out the time signature, the underlying rhythmic groupings and everything, and really work out like kind of this awesome tutorial / video. So yeah, be someone to check out too.
That's cool. I would definitely check him out. I love it when, I mean, that's another band that I mean, I have a few friends that definitely have figured out quite a bit of their stuff by ear and stuff, and but like there's a lot of little subtle tricky things in the rhythm.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean, when you listen to that, you're like, okay, I've kind of pretty much, I know this is a triplet feel, but A, it's like way more advanced triplet feel than I'm used to, or you know, like there's ghost notes, and the way the feel hits with the drums can be kind of tricky in that respect as well.
Yeah, no, it's incredible stuff. And on he breaks down a bit of Ludwig stuff as well, which is where I found him really and started getting to his stuff. He broke down some of the tracks on Tenet, which actually take a lot of inspiration from the Sugar's riffs as well. Like, really? He basically like plays these, Yogev. He plays what Ludwig was doing in the film score for Tenet in the style of Meshuggah. Like, he actually plays the riffs from the movie as if they were Meshuggah riffs. So plays the drums and plays the guitars, and he makes them sound like they sound like Meshuggah riffs when he plays them with the right instrumentation and everything.
Okay.
So close, which is cool. You can really see Ludwig took a lot of inspiration from, for particularly for that movie, from Meshuggah. I think he's a massive metal fan.
Cool. I've definitely now I'm really yeah. That's even more exciting to hear somebody kind of highlight the influence that's not readily noticeable in the style that it's being presented as.
Yeah.
And then flip it around, kind of like back in the day. I remember, and they're probably still doing it, but like you know, where like classical like orchestras and whatnot would like redo Metallica songs to show how great of compositions they were, you know, or other metal songs, you know. And I don't know if you remember that band Apocalyptica.
Yeah, I do. I haven't listened to much, but yeah, I do know them. Yeah.
They're cool, the cellos, you know, and doing different arrangements with those type of metal tunes. Sick. So it's like you could go, Mom, I know you don't like Metallica, but listen to this. Oh, this is pretty. They're not screaming. This is nice. Mom, this is Metallica. Metallica wrote this. Oh, yeah, they did?
Take that, Mom.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, what do you think about that, Mom?
Yeah. Well, at least they're not screaming. It's like, all right. Like, make this Metallica for moms. Apocalyptic.
Metallica for moms. That should be their selling point.
Yeah. Maybe. Mom mad at you for playing metal music too loud?
Yeah.
Listen to Apocalyptica. Yeah.
That's so good.
We got you. Well, Josh, thank you so much for hanging out and sharing some stories. It's super a big honor for me to talk to you and hear some of your kind of origin stories and all that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing what you do next, especially in respect to the album and the quintet and all this stuff. I'm interested in seeing what comes out of that.
It's gonna be
cool to see how you synthesize all these really unique and cool influences that you wear on your sleeve, but and you do so well at kind of like fine tuning out these transcriptions, that like to take all that work and then pour it into your own thing. Kind of excited.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today, man. It's been fun.
Players Pick Podcast, Picks and Perspective with Chris Johnson. Cool Table.